I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You can also find us on iTunes under Public Radio. Go down to KUCI. And tune in. The show, as always, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and business of writing. This is our new time slot, 9 a.m. Wednesdays, 9 a.m. Pacific time in any case. And a great way to start your day, get your writing mojo going. Today my guests are Steve Almond and T.J. Parcell. First up is Steve Almond. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Candy Freak, the story collections My Life in Heavy Metal and The Evil B.B. Chow, and the novel Which Brings Me to You with Juliana Baggett. He's here to talk about his new book, Not That You Asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions, published by Random House. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. I first became aware of your work with an essay I saw in a collection called Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant. It was a wonderful essay, a wonderful food essay, and I loved it. And then I just started looking you up and seeing what else you have done, and you've done such a range of things. The most recent, not that you asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions. Will you talk about how that book came about?
Sure. Well, it was originally the proposal I sent out was a kind of biography appreciation of Kurt Vonnegut, who I'd written about in college and worshipped in high school and college, and then, like a lot of authors, turned away from because he wasn't sophisticated enough, I guess. That was my perception of him as an unruly undergraduate trying to appear at all times sophisticated. And, you know, now I'm past 40, I'll say, and I realized that, in fact, Vonnegut was the reason I became a writer and the sort of writer that I am, which is to say a moralist and an emotionalist in blunt terms. And so I was excited to write about him and, in fact, went down and saw a panel that turned out I think was really the last public panel that he did in his life. And looked at my old thesis and went out and looked at Vonnegut's papers and was ready to write a book about him. And an editor at Random House said, well, we really like this stuff on Vonnegut, but we wonder if you'd be interested in putting out a book of essays about a range of topics. And as a fairly unrepentant, even joyously incoherent writer, I said, sure, I've got lots of essays about lots of different things. And I'd wanted to put some of that work into the world for quite a while. So I said, okay, sounds good. So there's a long essay about Vonnegut. It's kind of the anchor essay of the book. But then there are also essays about basically when I'm obsessed with something, I write about it. Not entirely, but when I'm writing essays, I try to write about stuff that I feel pretty passionately about. And so there are pieces about other writers that I admire and the political discourse in this country and the moral discourse in this country and my own adolescent sexual shame and reality TV and sort of pop culture pieces. So there's quite a range of stuff in there.
Interesting. Now, do you consider yourself primarily an essayist?
I consider myself a short story writer who is living in an era where I can't really support my family writing short stories. That's a pretty lame excuse. That's the form that I have written in the longest in 5 or 6 or 7 years of just steadily writing short stories and managed to, by hook or by crook, sneak a couple of story collections into the world. And I don't consider myself an essayist, or I really just consider myself a kind of writer, and whatever feels the most compelling to me is what I'm working on. But it's also shaped by my own the needs of my family. I should say that I'm familiar with Irvine because my girlfriend, then fiance, then wife, went to Irvine.
Oh, yeah.
And I visited a few times. She just graduated from their MFA program a year ago, and in fact, she is featured in the book as the person who, I schlepped across the country a couple of times while pregnant. She was pregnant, obviously not me. I'm familiar with UCI, and I would imagine that it's a lot nicer weather out there.
Oh, I don't know.
It is right now in Boston where I am.
Is it snowing?
It's not snowing, no, but it's good and chilly. The shadow of winter has come in. We have about 2 weeks of fall here where it's just gorgeous, and there's a nip in the air, and the leaves are changing, and then it switches over to yucky, slushy winter time. So it was very nice to visit Irvine during the winter months.
Yeah, but see, I miss snow. I'm an East Coast girl, and
yeah.
I always long for it.
You want to set up some sort of apartment swap for, say, maybe December through February. We are more than happy for you to experience the glorious snow of the Boston area.
Well, this brings me to my next question, which is, you are quite funny in everything I've written in a really kind of dry way, which is my favorite kind of humor. But I found another essay by you the other night at the bookstore in Tin House. A wonderful piece that is just such a whole other side of you, as well as, it seems, your material. Would you talk about that?
Well, which essay was that exactly?
Two Views of...
Rashid Kapuscinski?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, part of what's in Not That You Asked, and it's the kind of writing I do anyways, is writing about other writers, is sort of advocating for writers who are either overlooked or I don't feel have gotten sort of the proper appreciation. In as much as I'm writing, and I am delighted about that, in the end, the world's got plenty of writers. What we need is for readers to plug into the authors who will make them realize that literature is about them and their lives, not just some egg-headed thing that happens in libraries or in bookshops. So part of what I'm interested in doing, and Tin House and other venues allow me to do this, is to write about those writers who I think are spectacular. And Rashid Kapuscinski is a guy who I've been reading for years as a nonfiction writer. He began as a poet, but he essentially covered Latin America, Central America, and Africa, really from the 50s through the 80s. He covered many, many wars and revolutions, and he writes about especially these war-torn, poverty-stricken parts of the world in a way that is very plain-spoken and emotionally very bracing. It's impossible, in other words, to... he's really doing some of the work that Vonnegut does. He's a moralist. He's interested in how people function there, not the big war story or, you know, that makes the evening news, but the rhythm of what life is like and how you survive in a place where there's a lot of death and not a lot of food and a lot of desperation. And he writes about it sort of, to me, with the poet's ear. He's mm-hmm. able to capture what those experiences are like in human terms in ways that can't be, you can't just turn off the TV and say, oh, well, those poor folks suffering in such and such a country. So I've been a huge fan of his writing for years and very inspired by it. I remember writing short stories that were, if not direct ripoffs, that were inspired by this kind of miraculous style that he has. He's a really well-known secret among nonfiction writers. You know, there are people who kind of know about Kapuscinski, who will tip you off to him and say, man, you got to read Kapuscinski. So I always feel like I want to be able to do that, to tip people off to the books that I think are some of the best writing in the world, even though they might not be household names.
Mm-hmm. They aren't. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you doing that, because I wasn't aware of him. And such beautiful excerpts that were included.
Yeah, well,
and your wonderful piece.
That's the thing. I do a lot of book reviews as well, and I am really just sick to death of the kind of book reviews that don't quote the actual work. They seem to be about the author, the author's persona, all this crap. And they're not really about the book itself. You don't get a good sense as a reader of, well, what is this guy or this woman like?
Mm-hmm.
What's their prose like? What are their concerns? What is the rhythm and shape of their sentences? And so I always make it a point, especially when it's somebody whose writing is so extraordinary, to say, look, here it is. You be the judge. I'm not just whistling Dixie here. This guy can lights out write.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I felt about Rashid Kapuscinski.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Steve Allman today. He's author of the new book, Not That You Asked, Rants, Exploits, and Obsessions, published by Random House. So along those lines, Steve, instead of me saying how wonderful I think your writing is, would you read to us?
Yeah, absolutely. I will. I have an excerpt that is from that Vonnegut essay that I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
and I should just set it up briefly. This was the last panel that Vonnegut did before he died. He died a few months before the book came out, I'm sorry to say, and it was the only chance that I ever got to meet him in person, which, of course, I fantasized about incessantly when I was a Kurt Vonnegut fan, but it was a kind of a very upsetting panel for me to watch. It was Kurt Vonnegut, Joyce Carol Oates, and a writer named Jennifer Weiner.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Joyce Carol Oates is quite well known, and Jennifer Weiner is a writer of kind of smart relationship fiction. She's considerably younger than the other two, and you know, not like as big a name as they are. And the panel, this was Vonnegut really at the end of his life. And Oates started to antagonize him a little bit, and then he and Wiener got into it, not intentionally. It was something, I think, that was a reflection of the fact, well, I'll read about it, I guess. I'll read, this is just sort of the second half of the panel. After intermission came questions from the audience. Someone asked, what is the political responsibility of a writer? Vonnegut responded, we need to say what is the political responsibility of an American. Someone asked, what's the single most beautiful thing you've ever seen? Vonnegut said, my Lord, that's such a tough question because there's so much beauty, really. It's what keeps me going in life, is just glimpsing beauty all the time. I suppose the most beautiful thing, though you can't see it exactly, is music. Someone asked what his essential topic was. Vonnegut said, I write again and again about my family. Toward the end, a girl named Mary asked Vonnegut, can you sum up your philosophy of life in two sentences, and will you go to the prom with me? It is my senior year. It was the kind of setup Vonnegut should have knocked out of the ballpark, but he looked exhausted. More than that, he looked heartbroken. This is what Wiener and Oates seemed unable to grasp. The man was heartbroken. He had spent his entire life writing stories and essays and novels in the naked hope that he might redeem his readers. As grim and dystopic as some of those books were, every one was written under the assumption that human beings are capable of a greater decency. Now, in the shadow of his own death, he was facing the incontrovertible evidence that his life's work had been for naught. Right before his eyes, Americans had regressed to a state of infantile omnipotence. They drove SUVs and cheered for wars on TV and worshipped the beautiful and ignorant and despised the poor and brushed aside the science of their own doom. My philosophy of life, Vonnegut said, I haven't a clue. What about the prom? The moderator said, hopefully. Vonnegut made a crack about the girl being jailbait. It was a laugh line, and some people did laugh, but there was a terrible disappointment in the moment. Vonnegut, for all his gifts of compassion, was failing in a simple act of generosity. He knew that this girl, Mary, wanted only a taste of his wisdom, his famous wit. She had read his books, and like all his fans, she had come to love him as a kind of father, someone who had seen the worst of human conduct and refused to lie about the sort of trouble we were in, but who had not allowed his doubt to curdle into cynicism, who, for all his dark prognostication, was a figure of tremendous hope. Evidence was in his books, which performed the greatest feat of alchemy known to man, the conversion of grief into laughter by means of courageous imagination. Like any decent parent, he had made the astonishing sorrow of the examined life bearable. And this was what Mary wanted from him now, a little of his old magic. So did the rest of the folks sitting in the Bushnell Theater in downtown Hartford, not just the ones who stood and applauded when he was introduced, all us drooling acolytes, but the ones who regarded him merely as an eloquent grump, a fading prophet, an old man shouting the world off his porch. And Vonnegut seemed to know it, too. He gazed out at the audience, not unlike his hero Twain with his inexhaustible charms, but in the silent burden of our present condition, his image was magnified eerily. Video screen overhead. The camera shook for a moment. He looked stricken. I thought of that passage in Breakfast of Champions where, in exhaustion, Vonnegut drops the fictional disguise altogether. Quote, this is a very bad book you're writing, I said to myself. I know, I said. You're afraid you'll kill yourself the way your mother did, I said. I know. I thought of Vonnegut, a 21-year-old private, returning to Indianapolis to bury his mother after she took her own life, and his imprisonment in Dresden just a few months later, all that ash and death, the passing of his sister, the madness of his son, his own suicide attempt in the haunted year of 1984. The camera was still fixed on Vonnegut's face, and it occurred to me with great clarity that he was going to die before he could say another word. He would simply and quietly sit back in his chair and perish. Instead, he gathered himself and smiled at all the nice strangers for him and said with an almost girlish lilt, of course I'll go to the prom with you, Mary, and I love to dance. And though nobody quite realized it, including Vonnegut himself, he had, with those two fine sentences, answered both her questions.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. That was Steve Almond reading from Not That You Asked, and it's one of the first essays in the book, wonderful piece. Called, I'm paging back to the start.
Called Everything Was Beautiful and Nothing Hurt.
Nothing Hurt.
Failed Prophecy of Kurt Vonnegut and How It Saved My Life.
Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you.
Sure.
You mentioned earlier that your essays come from passion about a topic. Could you say a little more about that? I mean, do you have ideas that flutter through that you're passionate about for a minute and then you're not anymore and they go? Or what do? You start things and put them aside if you find not enough energy to maintain the writing of the piece?
I think that's right. I mean, that's really the way it works with writers. You have to be obsessed with your topic. If you're not, you can't do the lonely work of writing, which really consists of thousands and thousands of decisions that you have to make in solitude with no sure guide of what the right decisions are. You know, what word to choose, what sentence, what ideas, what paragraph, what detail. It's really lonely, grinding work. And I think the only thing that drives me through it anyway, and I don't mean to lionize it, I mean there are lots of other things that are difficult, but for me, I love to write. It's how I connect to the world. And it, at the same time, paradoxically, it's my least favorite thing to do. It's extraordinarily difficult. Writers who are like, oh, I just love writing. I wrote for 12 hours. You hear these myths about, you know, Kerouac writing, you know, amped up on amphetamines and coffee and writing on the road in 6 weeks. Or, you know, that's not how it is for me ever. It's always a struggle. And so what makes that struggle worthwhile, or what drives it, the engine of it for me, is obsession. And it means that there are certain things that stick in my craw that I need to somehow write about. It doesn't mean I need to write an essay about them. Sometimes it's an episode that is really more appropriate to writing a short story. But it just means that the things that stick in my mind, whether it's a childhood memory or something I hear when I'm, you know, when I'm taking the subway in Boston or something I see, those are things that somehow are stuck in there, and I've got to try to, you know, like the sand and the oyster or something, I've got to sort of work them over again and again, try and figure out what they're about. So, you know, this book is filled with that kind of stuff. If I have a weird, crazy experience, especially a difficult or painful experience, and I can't get over it or past it, I try to move through it with the writing.
Interesting. So then, and I see you have a novel.
Yes.
What becomes a novel?
Well, the novel is an odd thing. It's a one-off because it was really another writer, Juliana Baggett, who essentially said, I think we should write a novel, and I have, you know, a plot in mind that I think is going to play to your strengths. And she was right. It was, you know, it's a novel about, you know, two people who meet at a wedding, you know, fall, get together in the coat room and start getting ready to do the deed. And then, and this is where female readers might find it a bit credulous, the man stops and says, wait a second, I actually really like you, and I don't want to mess this up. You know, we're both in our mid-30s, and we've had enough tough experiences romantically. This seems like it might be something more than that, so let's not mess it up. Let's write letters instead to each other, confessing, you know, to our past relationship. He sort of says it as a lark. They're both drunk. but then they go ahead and you know, it's kind of like a game of chicken. They do start confessing to one another, and then at the end they, well, hopefully they don't, you have to read the book, but, you know, the idea that we wrote it in mind was that you sort of, you have to face up to the mistakes you've made in the past before you have any sort of hope of making it work with somebody in the long term. So I, of course, as somebody who didn't get married until my late 30s, had plenty of material to draw from.
I want to read that one.
It sounds like fun. It is. It's what we're always doing. You know, we're always telling the story of our life. And that doesn't mean that it's necessarily in book form or a short story or an essay or something, but it's just what people do. I know this from having worked as a journalist for 5 or 6 years. People are, it's the mode of consciousness. They're confessional by nature. They want their story out. There's a great line by the writer Nick Hornby. He has this fabulous memoir called Fever Pitch. It's one of his earliest books. And the first line is, it's all in there trying to find a way to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's really how I feel about, he's writing about his obsession with the sports team. But it could apply to anything. You know, whatever we're obsessed with is sort of the map of who we are inside.
Yeah. That's a good one. Well, how long will you spend on an essay? The essays in Not That You Asked. Talk about that. I mean, how will you spend weeks? Will you give yourself a limit? Will you just see what it takes? How does it go?
Yeah, well, it goes differently. I mean, you know, when I'm writing my best, I would say it goes more quickly and more naturally. And that's what you hope for, you know, that a good essay, I think, is almost like a good letter to the reader. It's not freighted with the accoutrements and ornamentation of style. It's just a direct expression. It's your effort to get to the truth as fast as you can, knowing that the truth probably lies on the other side of the great pasture of shame and embarrassment and envy and all the emotions that, you know, that you're trying to avoid in your everyday life, but that are kind of boiling around inside you. So the Vonnegut pieces, for instance, it's a three-part essay. I wrote those relatively quickly because I just wanted to set down, like, that the experience at the panel, that terrible feeling of Vonnegut at the end of his life, you know, and his life's work, knowing in some sense that his life's work had gone for naught, or feeling that way anyway, in the shadow of his own death. I needed to get that written just so that I could tell somebody how sad I felt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other essays. There's a long essay in the book called Red Sox Antichrist that's about being a sports fan and what that means and what it's like to be a sports fan in exile. It sounds like you spent some time in the East Coast, so now you're really living on the other side of the country. I grew up in Northern California and, you know, have this sort of doomed loyalty to the same team, and now the Oakland A's, and now I'm living in the midst of Red Sox Nation. So it's partly about that experience. That essay took weeks to write because I tried to put everything in it, and, you know, it was way too long, and there was way too much information, and I needed to somehow be prevailed upon by my readers and finally myself to cut out, you know, to separate the wheat from the chaff and get rid of the stuff that wasn't essential. That's mostly how my revision process is. I write a lot, and then I try to get brutal with myself about getting rid of what's inessential, because readers don't really have time for that. You know, when you read a great book, it's because you get the sense that the author isn't wasting your time. There's no extra words. There's no extra thoughts or characters. They're just getting as quickly as possible to the truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we should have booked an hour because our time is just about up, and I'd like to talk to you about so much more. So I hope you come back with your next book, or when this one goes into paperback, or sometime soon. In the meantime, I wonder if you have any last words of wisdom for the writers listening, particularly those working on essays and shorter pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few things that I try to say to beginning writers. Most bad writing, and I don't mean bad, I mean most writing that's inessential, say, is a product of insecurity. And the bottom line is, you know, I try to sort of, I don't set out to have a style. I think that's disastrous. I just try to set out to tell the truth or get to the emotionally dangerous moments in an essay or a story. And that's what creates your style, is the effort to grapple with those complex and charged emotional states. So I would recommend that people not try to have a style, that they focus on just writing as plainly as they can or in as natural a voice as they can about the things that matter to them the most deeply. I don't mean that it should be, you know, free of crafting. It's not a journal entry, but I think that so many times beginning writers make mistakes out of the insecurity over the story they're telling. Their job really is to just get to the emotionally dangerous moments and investigate those.
Interesting. That's great advice. That's great advice. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I know you have a MySpace page that people can find you on.
You know, I do. I don't really, that was set up for me, so I don't know anything really about MySpace. The excerpts from the book, though, are available at CandyFreak, you know, just one word, .com.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, if people, I guess, want to check that out or see what I'm up to or what the
That'd be great.
To say, yeah, that's probably the best way to do it.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Sure, absolutely.
That was Steve Almond. He's author of a few books, the last of which is Not That You Asked, published by Random House. Lots of great pieces. And what we all know as writers and readers is that to keep publishing alive, we have to invest in books. So remember that. I was in the bookstore the other night and found his essay in Tin House, and I don't know that I've ever bought a Tin House. I think I usually check it out online, but I was thinking, you know, if we don't buy these journals, who will? We writers who want to write for them. So plunk down the cash and pick up some books and keep it going. New books, too. Used books are great. I buy them all the time, but I got to buy new books, too, to keep publishing moving. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll be with T.J. Parcell, author of Fish. So stick around.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
What is this profession called coaching? What is a coach? No, not football, not soccer, not even tennis. By now, you must have heard the terms life coaching or executive coaching or even business coaching. Come find out on Coaching Conversations with me, Patricia Hirsch, where I interview coaches from around the world, mainly from the 12,000-plus membership of the International Coach Federation, where coaches are becoming certified. Coaching Conversations with Patricia Hirsch, alternate Fridays at 9 a.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine. Find out more on the show's website at www.patriciahirsch.com. That's PATRICIAHIRSCH.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
my lost youth. And here's to where it went. And here's to all my old friends and the good times that we spent. Things will never be like they were back then. Don't you know you can't go home again? You can't go home again. And I once was a child on a summer's day, running with the wind, laughing all the way. And deep within my heart, someone says, hey friend, don't you know you can't go home again? You can't go home again. And I guess I've outlasted all my ego, and all my dreams are fading fast. I'm right down at the end of the rainbow. There's an old hand tinted photograph of me when I was young, 1963, back when I was sure the sun was shining just for me. And it will never shine like it did back then. You know you can't go home again. You can't go home again. I guess I've outlasted all my heroes, and all my dreams are fading fast. And right down at the end of the rainbow, there's an old hand tinted photograph of me and my lost youth, and me and my old dad, me and all my old friends, the good times that we had. Friends will never be like they were back then. Don't you know you can't go home again? And you can't go home again.
Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. I've been trying to reach TJ Parcell and his number doesn't work. So if you're out there, TJ, call me at 949-UCI-KUCI. That's also the number that anyone can call if you want to chat about writing or have a comment to make. In any case, I'm going to put on more music and see if we reach him. Stick around, get out your tablet, sit at your computer, start writing, okay? Let the music drive you. See what happens. Don't go away.
Thank you. fall on you now. One day it's all gonna fall down on you.
Funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Oh, your looks are laughable. Unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak when you it to speak? Are you smart? Oh, but don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? Oh, but don't change your hair for me. Not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine. Stay. Each day is Valentine's. Each day is Valentine's. Each day is Valentine's.
Non ti fidare d'un bacio a mezzanotte, se c'è la luna non ti fidare, perché, perché la luna a mezzanotte riesce sempre a farti innamorare. Non ti fidare di stelle galeotte che invitano a volersi amare. Mezzanotte per amar, mezzanotte per sognare fantastica.
Ma come farò senza più amare? Ma come farò senza baciare? Ma come farò a non farmi tentare? Luna, luna, tu non mi guardare, luna, luna, tu non curiosare, luna, luna, tu non far la sentinella. Ogni stella in ciel parla al mio cuore, ogni stella in ciel parla d'amore, ogni stella in ciel sarà la mia stella. Mezzanotte per amar, mezzanotte per sognar fantastica.
Non ti fidare d'un bacio a mezzanotte,
senza baciare,
se c'è la luna non ti fidare, perché, perché la luna a mezzanotte
non curiosare,
riesce sempre a farla innamorare. Non ti fidare di stelle galeotte,
parla d'amore, ogni stella sarà la mia stella. Mezzanotte per amare, mezzanotte per sognare, fantastica.
Oh Lord, why did you send the darkness to me? And the shadows forever to be. Where's the light I'm longing to see? Love once met me by the old willow tree. Now you've gone and left nothing to me. Nothing but a sweet memory.
Thank you. your branches green along the stream that runs to the sea. Listen to my plea. Listen, willow, and weep for me. Gone my lover's dream, lovely summer dream. Gone and left me here to weep my tears into the stream. Sad as I can be, hear me, willow, and weep for me. Whisper to the wind and say that love has sinned to leave my heart a-breaking and making a moan. Murmur to the night to hide her starry light so none will find me sighing and crying all alone. Weep in a willow tree, weep in sympathy. Bend your branches down along the ground and cover me. When the shadows fall, bend, oh willow, and weep for me. I want you to weep for me, willow tree.
Did find T.J. Parcell. Sorry about that, but we had a great first guest, Steve Almond. And if you're here now and you weren't here then, check out the podcast later on in a week or so, and I'll have Steve Almond show up on there. You can find it by going to my website, penonfire.com, clicking on the radio tower. It'll take you to the radio page, and you'll find all you need to know regarding the schedule and how to listen to podcasts. We have about, I don't know, 170, 180 up at this point. In any case, I am going to leave you again with a quote, as I usually do, by Grace Yonne, who said, "Good things, when short, are twice as good." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. and I'll see you next time.